You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking, on with the podcast. Hello and welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Colin, and with me are my comrades and co-hosts, Tracy.
Hello.
And Ian.
Hello.
Each episode, we take a letter of the alphabet and pick two bands, one well-known, one less so, and talk about what we like, what we don't like, and anything in between. This week, we're going to be talking about the letter H, which apparently, I've just been informed, is pronounced H. I've always said H, but as we know, I pronounce things in my own way, because I'm a maverick.
Yes.
I'm a pioneer.
Not just wrong.
I'm a renegade.
Yep.
So I'm going to be pronouncing it H, because that's got the fucking letter in the name.
We've already had this, though.
I know.
L, but anyway. E-L, X, E-X.
X. So, the letter H. So today we're going to be discussing hate breeds.
Yep.
And PJ Harvey.
Now is the time for me to rise to my feet. Wipe your spit from my face. Wipe these tears from my eyes. Now is the time for me to rise to my feet. Wipe your spit from my face. Wipe these tears from my eyes. I've got to take my life.
Our first band is Hatebreed. Apparently, according to Wikipedia, they're an American metalcore band. I would absolutely have classified them as straight-up hardcore, yeah, with more metal leanings than, yeah, metalcore, personally. Formed in 1994, they've done 7 studio albums, which is more than I was aware of. Yeah, their musical style blends hardcore punk and heavy metal. Mostly just hardcore. But anyway, frontman Jamie Jaster is the only... Jamie Jaster and the bass player are the only original members, but no one knows about bass players. He doesn't do anything fancy, so he doesn't get credit.
He plays stompy, stompy bass for him.
Yeah, but yeah, Jamie Jaster, lead singer, very positive and inspirational man, I think, in his lyric writing.
Angry
guitar. Super angry.
I think... With what you were just saying there, one of the things I was thinking that would be good to talk about on this, because not everybody listening will know, what is hardcore? So hardcore...
It's just a heavier version of punk, really.
It's a heavier version of punk, but there's certain things in there that define it. There are... you've got... There's a thing called the D-beat.
Yes.
Which is the... That's my terrible beatboxing.
Which is,
get the idea of,
yes, super necessary. That is definitely a pivotal. They don't do D beats a lot. I
noticed a fair few, to be honest.
It's a lot more groove based, which I guess is where they're getting the metal
thing comes from. But then there's a lot of, in hardcore, you have a lot of there's like breakdown sections,
yeah,
where the music will go like half speed and just. So, you know, most of the song will be like breakneck, really, really fast, and then it will suddenly halve the speed and just go extra stompy. And you've also got, there's quite often like crowd backing vocals.
Yeah, crowd mob
Call
vocals are definitely
vocals.
The thing.
Yeah.
Or a key thing.
Yeah.
And it's, lyrically, it's usually a little bit more positive, quite often political or social.
Yeah.
And, yeah. It's more uplifting, more,
yeah,
real, less fantasy metal,
yeah,
type.
Now, I'm
not much of a hardcore listener, to be honest. I like some of the bits that I've heard. I've really, really enjoyed listening to Hatebreed. I've really, really dug it.
It's I find it really hard not to. When I listen to them, I put them on. It's my gym music. It's right. Every time I go to the gym.
That makes sense.
Because like, he sounds like a gym instructor, doesn't he?
I'm not going to that gym.
Like, whatever the lyrics he's saying, all I can hear is him going, "You can lift it! Pick it up, you fucking pussy!" And that's basically what it does for me.
He's like a motivational speaker.
Yeah.
And some of the lyrics are almost like, you know, in offices where you get those motivational...
They really are.
But it's like a really angry office.
Yeah, like looking...
Destroy everything!
Exactly, because the opening line to that is, "A new life begins."
Yes.
Like, yes. Ah! Positive.
I'm wondering if we can somehow make these lyrics into motivational posters.
Jamie Jasta motivational posters.
Stick them up into offices around the country.
That would be amazing.
See how long just it takes a little for somebody to notice.
Poster of someone sat on a mountain with "Smash your enemies."
Some lyrics of his I read. I think it's from This Is Now, and I'm not entirely sure that we could make a motivational poster from "What's done is done. It's time to start again." Well, maybe.
Yeah. See, you've just done it.
Can't let it tear me in two, waste me away.
I'm absolutely sure I've been involved in meetings at, not necessarily in my current job, but in previous jobs, where the overall message of the meeting is, "What's done, it's done, it's time to start again."
Yep.
Maybe. I don't know, but when you read that kind of disjointed like that, it looks a bit sixth form to me.
It is. It's not the most intelligent lyricism, that's
not
for sure.
But I mean, I read some, while I was researching this, I read some reviews. One of them, which I thought entirely missed the point, is a review of their first album. And it said, "Grab a baseball bat and a wife beater and sing along."
No, that, I'm like, that's, what? That's a hardcore thing. The wife beater shirt thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's like
a
vest.
A white vest.
Yeah, they're not talking about Stella, which is the other wife beater.
Yeah.
Or, you know...
Yeah, they're
Chris Brown, for instance, different kind of wife beater.
Yeah.
The hardcore I'm most familiar with is stuff like Biohazard.
Yeah.
And they were always wearing these white vest type things. And I'm fairly certain probably carrying baseball bats some of the time.
Yeah. It's yeah.
You see,
look at me, aren't I really menacing? Kind of.
I've got a big, like, bulldog on it.
I mean, I listened to it and I just thought, actually, this is quite Black Flag, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Black Flag were a hardcore band, basically. So, yeah.
And I liked it.
Who's not influenced by Rollins? Really? Have you been around Rollins? Have you heard Rollins? Then you're influenced by him because you can't not be.
But then I read this other review and it said, did some kid steal your lunch money in grade 3 and you couldn't do anything about it? Well, you can just go to a psychologist or you can deal with your fucking problems just like everyone else and push on. Anyone who listens to this is a typical angry, sad little fucking wrist-slashing teenager who wants attention and people's mercy. Grow up and listen to some real metal.
What the fuck?
So, I know!
I tell you what tells you the most, in that status... in that review is the phrase, "and listen to some real metal."
Yeah. I know, well, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
What's real metal then?
Probably that's back.
Yeah. The person that wrote that I would be the kind of person that says Five Finger Death Punch are real metal, which means he is a penis.
But he really annoyed me though, because I just thought, what, men can't be angry in any meaningful way in music?
Yeah, because I mean, all of the lyrics, they're not childish, are they? It might be a bit sixth form, but it is very, you know.
Well, I mean, that review.
You've got this, dude. It's not like, oh no, everything sucks. It's like, it sucks, I'm fixing it.
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, the review pissed me off, and it made me want to champion the genre, to be honest.
Yeah.
And the thing that sort of, that I'd mainly got in my head while I was listening to it is Public Image Limited quote, "Anger is an energy."
Yeah.
That's the basic vibe. It's like, now, to be fair, I'm not a very angry person. Don't get angry these days much.
Yeah.
I can't be arsed with it. I'm a fairly chilled person. But I still found it really, really fun to listen to. There's definitely been times in the past when I was younger where I would have been really, really angry at everything in the world. And these songs really would have spoken to me at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not saying, admittedly, destroy everything. Is saying destroy everything. But it's saying destroy everything and start again. So it's saying... Yeah. There's a way forward, sort of thing.
Deal with your problems.
Yeah.
By destroying them, but still.
I thought one of the songs that you put on the track list to listen to for this was almost a bit goth, actually.
Really? Is that one of the Kingdom of Sorrow ones?
No. At least I don't think so. It was Screaming Into the Sky.
Kingdom of Sorrow.
Kingdom of Sorrow, okay. Which was quite atmospheric.
I wanted more from that side project. Because
it's made as a crowbar.
Kirk from Crowbar, yeah. Like, who also sounds like a gym instructor.
Yeah.
Like, all of his lyrics... Well, not... It's a very different lyrical forefront, because they're super depressing, Crowbar are. They're intense and bleak.
And they're like, sort of... They're sludge metal.
Yeah,
kind of thing. So they've
got some hardcore tendencies in.
Yes,
but their vocal delivery style—they are fairly similar. Just like,
I've got to admit, by the time I got to the Kingdom of Sorrow stuff on that Spotify list you put together, I'd got a bit bored, really.
It is,
and I went off and listened to Big Black. And then some Rape Man, and then some Shellac, and I went off on a great big Albini binge.
That's no bad thing.
So
no.
And it was a brilliant night, actually.
Well, the thing about it being a bit samey, one thing that I did notice is Jamie Jaster only has one note.
Yes.
All of the songs are one note, and it is G. I checked. I was listening to it, and I was like, I'm just going to walk over to the piano. No, it's not an F. To G, yeah. Right, all of his songs are G.
Yeah, he doesn't
Excellent.
Really... He's just like... It's just very...
Yeah.
But, you know, having been in a metal band and gone with the rhythmic shouting thing rather than the pick and a melody thing, I feel like I can't comment on that one, really.
I mean, it's weird, though, because, I mean, Hatebreed might have... a lot heavier guitars and shoutier vocals, but I think the earlier hardcore is more intense.
Yes.
I mean, I guess it's about frames of reference, though, isn't it? Because I come at it from, you know, a different angle, more like the lo-fi, no-wave stuff, you know. Your Sonic Youth, your Husker Du, your Swans.
Yeah, I mean, this is, produced. It's really aggressively produced and... There's nothing lo-fi about it at all, is there, really?
No.
But, I don't know.
Going back to... I know we've sort of gone for this bit, but the metalcore thing... I mean, I hate the phrase metalcore. Because
yeah.
I hate any genre with core at the end of it.
It's hardcore.
It was mostly people... Like metalcore.
No, I mean the name. Sadcore, slowcore,
yeah,
things
it's
like
a bit
that.
Of a lazy... Like, yeah. Just pick a fucking... Like, yeah. Pick a new... word to couple with that.
Don't and not new. What like a, new
like
metal.
A, post-core.
Yeah.
I mean, they did post-hardcore, I guess, but...
Yeah.
But that was the ultimate genre fucking mash, wasn't
it? Post-core is lighter post-hardcore, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Got rid of the hard bit. This is like soft post-hardcore.
Post-core.
Post-core.
We just took the hard away.
But yeah, I think there is a lot of influence from thrash, and groove metal as well, particularly in like the bass playing.
They got described somewhere I read as hardcore crust.
No,
I wasn't hearing that. The crusty side.
You get breakdowns in crust, I guess, maybe, but. That's about it. I don't know. It seems like you read a load of reviews written by people that don't really understand what the fuck is going on.
Perhaps.
Which, I mean, you know, that's fair. I always find it really interesting to... Yeah, I love listening to people who aren't into that kind of music in all genres. like their idea, their where they think it's coming from.
Yeah.
You know, like my band, someone came up and went, "Oh, it really reminds me of Deftones." Like, does it?
Really?
I mean, like, I like Deftones, but
I can see where they're coming because for people that haven't heard Ian's band, they're kind of like post-metal,
yeah,
sort of thing. But I can see the Deftones' later stuff as reminding people of post-metal if they're not familiar with Isis, Bosk, Cult of Luna.
I mean, obviously Chino does like that genre, having done Palms, which is like collaboration with members from Isis.
People have got to grab onto
the band.
People have got to grab onto their frame of reference, haven't they?
Yeah.
So I can remember playing my dad Korn back in about 97, and he said it sounded like Chemical, who were and still are. They're a really long-lasting band from Tampa.
Yeah, probably one of the most...
They're the longest-running band
in Tamworth, without...
definitely. Possibly the Midlands.
I'd have said so, yeah. Them and Disarm Goliath.
Yeah, and they're a metal band that have changed genres a fair bit, but have never really been new metal.
Not really.
So, but I think what my dad was latching onto is that when he particularly heard them, they'd got kind of screamy, shouty vocals, a bit like Jonathan Davis has got, and because that's not really the frame of reference for stuff my dad listens to, that was the closest thing he'd got to latch onto.
That makes sense.
So, I did like Hatebreed. They're the kind of band that I think you only need one album by if you need.
Oh, for sure, because they're like AC/DC.
Yeah,
but a super positive.
But as we've discussed before, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, God no. I didn't even realise that the guitarist who was really long running with them had left.
Yeah.
I've heard their most recent album and it just sounds like Hatebreed. They went from one guitarist to two guitarists and I couldn't tell the difference, and I don't see the point in them having two guitarists, to be honest. They just play the same riff.
They do seem to be. There's not much sort of interplay between the two guitarists, is there?
No. So they're... Yeah, they've got a formula. They're a fucking blast live, though.
Yeah,
I'm not a fist puncher. I'm not an air punching dude, not at all. But when I saw them at Bloodstock, I definitely did. I got involved.
Yeah,
I stood at the back. I pumped the air with my fist, and I felt super motivated. Yeah. Then I did some press ups.
With the motivational thing, it's part of my notes. I've written self-belief, defiance, I can run up Everest, I can fight a bear, I can punch the moon in the face.
Yeah.
That's what he's telling you, man.
Yeah.
Particularly fighting a bear. He strongly recommends that you...
Yeah, he hasn't explicitly said it at any point, but...
You have to play the tracks backwards.
Yeah, I reckon...
If there's backmasking in there.
I mean, if he's saying destroy everything, then he definitely classifies
bears.
Yeah,
exactly. I found one more genre name that was actually thrown at them.
Go on, man.
Brocore.
Ooh, that's a mean one. That's definitely
a mean one, but I can see it. I can see it appealing to...
I can see some of their fans definitely... Because a lot of bands are defined by their fans, aren't they?
They are, and I think...
Well, they have to be.
Yeah.
Well, I think part of this comes into the sort of divide and the differences between UK fans and American fans.
Yeah.
Mentioning one of the earlier episodes briefly how new metal was briefly defined by some journalists as sports metal. None of us over here... We were all the ones hiding from doing PE. We were the metal kids.
And your ridiculous baggy trousers. You can't run in those.
Exactly. But in America, my perception is that a lot of those bands were being listened to by the jocks.
Yeah.
Again, from the AC/DC episode, this time we are talking about sports people, not Scottish people.
People.
I mean, having said that it makes me lift weights at the gym, then I guess that's
it. And I think with the brocore thing, I think there is a bit of a subset of particularly American hardcore fans who are possibly the kind of people that are going to just beat the crap out of you if you look at them funny.
Oh, God, yeah.
You do. I mean, there are, even though this is really positive hardcore, there are subsets of hardcore that have got really sort of dodgy, you know, you get like Nazi hardcore bands. And stuff.
You do. And like, I mean, the straight edge movement, while in essence is super positive and like, you know, live healthy, be healthy. Yeah. You know, they've got a reputation for walking around fucking knocking drinks of beer out of people's hands, like,
yeah.
And it's not a very inclusive.
Yeah, exactly.
Which flies in the face of what hardcore is meant to be about, because it's meant to be inclusive. We're all in this together. We've got, you know, like, you've had, like, I mean, it is the most, how to say this, like, you've got Bad Brains. I mean, that's just like,
oh, yeah.
Bunch of black dudes playing hardcore. You've always had different ethnicities playing hardcore.
They were right in the first wave.
It's a super accepting genre. In essence,
it's the same as where you've got you've got the skinhead wing of punk over here, where you've got you've got the National Front turning up to gigs by the Specials and stuff like that. When, you know, half of the band were black.
Yeah.
And
there's always people that miss the point.
Nazi punk stuff. Yeah.
Mm.
Well, we know what Nazi punks can do.
Yes.
Fuck off. But I really enjoyed Hatebreed. I really enjoyed listening to them. Like I said, one album's probably enough. But it's nice, stumpy, 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 stumpy fun.
One thing I was going to say, and that I found really weird about the play, because we do a playlist, and whoever's picked the band will do like 8 tracks. I did the Hatebreed one, obviously, and I'm assuming that Tracy did the PJ Harvey one,
having a bit of a collaboration.
But like, and then we just mashed them together to do the homework.
Yeah.
So anyone that hasn't listened to them, you've got like, you know, Hatebreed, PJ Harvey, Hatebreed. It just alternates, and fuck me, I felt so empowered, like, as a person and as a woman.
Fantastic.
After my trip to work, which was, it's a weird scenario, but I, you know, it was fine. I dug it.
That's amazing.
It really is.
Didn't let anyone mansplain to me all day. It was kick ass.
Brilliant. Should we start talking about PJ Harvey then?
Yeah, let's.
Why Excellent. Not? Nice segue. I lost my heart under the bridge to that little girl. So much to me, and now I moan, and now I holler. She'll never know just what I.
Polly Jean Harvey, MBE, is a singer, songwriter, guitarist, saxophonist from Dorset. She's released 11 albums now, from 1992 to 2016, two of which were collaborations with John Parrish, who was the frontman of her previous band, the Automatic Dlamini. I've never known how to pronounce that.
How do you even spell that?
Dlamini.
I've just realised that I'm probably the worst person to ask.
Yeah, I'm not even going to ask you.
It's pronounced daffodils.
Dalmatian.
Yeah,
that'll do. Don't know, is it not?
The automatic Dlamini. Daffodils. Yeah. That's the new fads.
That's what I was on about.
Anyway.
PJ Harvey was in the
in new fads.
New fast automatic daffodils. You heard it here first.
So John Parrish, yeah, her collaborations, and she's described him as her musical soulmate. So she's the only artist to have won the Mercury Prize twice, for the first time in 2001 with Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea, and then again in 2011 for Let England Shake. And everyone thinks she's a solo artist, but the first two albums weren't actually a solo project at all. Dry and Rid of Me was a three-piece band.
I thought it was only the first album was recorded as the band PJ Harvey.
Yeah.
I believe after that, I think it was.
I think it was different
musicians on the second one.
I don't think so. I didn't think so. I thought it was. I thought it was still Alice and Oliver, but
I could be wrong. Sorry.
And I thought it was during the Rid of Me tour that it all fell apart.
You could be
and
right.
And that she went solo after that, but I could be corrected. But yeah, her solo career officially begins from To Bring You My Love in 1993.
But it's all part. Nobody sees them as two separate things.
No, not at all. Not at all. No.
If you're going to call your band after your actual name, then
yeah.
People are just going to make that assumption.
Well, yeah, but I mean, well, at the time she said she played around with lots of different things and nothing felt right, so that's why they called it PJ Harvey. I was into Polly right from the first single, Dress. I saw them live on the Dry Tour in 92 at a tiny little club attached to Preston North End Football Club, and it was just amazing. It blew me away. I mean, Dry is a perfect album. It came in right at the end of grunge, really. All heavy guitar riffs and pounding bass and clattering drums. But what she brings to it, the directly candid lyrics and surging sexual politics. I mean, for me, in 92, the timing was perfect. Just a call to arms for a young feminist. And, and Colin, Ian, I'm not guessing in 1992 you would are identifying yourselves as a young feminist.
Well, I was definitely young.
Yeah, no, I was young as well.
How did you hear the first single? What was it, John Peel or?
Actually, no, it was, someone did me a mixtape and put it on.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, my friend David.
I love mixtapes.
I know.
Mm. It's the best way of getting into things, definitely. I miss them.
Can I name drop?
Yeah, of course.
My The guy that did me the mixtape, David, it's actually David Chambers, the original drummer of Corner Shop. I was great friends with him in Preston at the time,
yes.
And lived in a house with him for some years. He had the first single because he was a DJ in Preston, so he had everything. And he put it on a tape for me, along with a whole load of other stuff. And then we went to see her, a couple of months after that.
What sort of capacity was it, that venue? Was it like really... Talking a couple of hundred? Or?
Yeah, a couple of hundred.
Awesome.
Really, like almost nobody there.
Yeah. Amazing. I first heard PJ Harvey it would have been 95. It was a free cassette with Vox magazine, which Vox magazine was ace. It was like a monthly, quite thick,
kind of like Select or something.
It was just like Select, yeah. The same cassette got me into Therapy and Foo Fighters. All three of them were on the same cassette. But it,
two out of three.
Yeah.
I don't mind the Foo Fighters. Sorry, I don't. I don't, but...
That was the first Foo Fighters album, which is great.
Oh, all right, yeah.
That is great.
But, it got Down by the Water on it. I was convinced for ages that it got Come On Billy on it, and I looked it up and it was Down by the Water.
Same album though.
Yeah, same album. Yeah. They're both off To Bring You My Love.
Yes.
But I didn't buy the album at the time, but I really liked that track.
Yeah.
But then when I properly got into it was a couple of years later, when she was on TFI Friday doing A Perfect Day Elise, which was the first single on Is This Desire?
Yeah.
Which that record's got sort of, it's almost like trip hop influence.
Do you know, that's exactly what I've got written down on my notes. Kind of trippy.
Yeah, well, it's not just trippy, it's trip hop. It's got.
I'd love to hear. I think it was Angeline. I'd love to hear a trip hop mix of that, actually.
Yeah. Well, she worked with Trickett around the sort of same kind of time.
Of course.
So she definitely got that kind of Bristol scene influence coming in.
Yeah. Was that when Tricky was working with everyone, like Garbage and Bjork and stuff like that?
I think it was on the Nearly God project that he did. It was around that sort of time, I think.
But then that album, I mean, there's quite a lot of different instrumentation. It's where she started experimenting, I think, with different instrumentation on it. And there's a track on there, The Wind, which just begins... with whispered vocals, a really low guitar line, and it almost sounds like Slint. before the real vocals come in, and it's just breathtaking. Listen to it again, honestly.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I know the song really well. I just never thought of it that way.
Of it being Slint. It was just that the whispered vocals just made me think Slint. And
yeah. But that sort of there onwards is my kind of era for PJ Harvey.
Yeah.
So it was those three albums, To Bring You My Love, Is This Desire, and then Stories from the Sea. That was my sort of big, really being into PJ Harvey sort of time.
And it's weird, I don't know anybody who agrees on what their favourite Polly album is. Because as a precursor to doing this podcast, I actually spent a week just listening to her entire back catalogue. And it was a pure indulgent joy, to be honest. Listen to almost nothing but Polly for the week.
I thought that was really interesting because you were sort of almost live blogging on Twitter doing it. And people's replies, everybody was saying, oh, I prefer this album.
Yeah, no, this is my favourite. Really, that's my least favourite. I like this one. And yeah, no one agrees. But I mean, it was really nice to go back and visit a lot of the stuff that I'd kind of neglected.
You didn't have To Bring You My Love, did you, at all? You completely missed that one?
I didn't own it, but I knew the stuff. The one I didn't know, actually, really, was the 2004 album. And actually, I think anybody could skip that entirely and really not miss it.
It's got a couple of good tracks on it, but it was a big disappointment after Stories from the City, Sorry from the Sea. And I think a lot of that was to do with it. I mean, it's very Queens of the Stone Age influence. It's got a. I think it's the letter. The guitar really, really sounds like it could be off Queens of the Stone Age.
Yeah, album. I mean, there is a slight. After Stories from the City, actually does have a slight return to guitar tunes, but.
Yeah.
But it's a laid-back album in the main, and I don't know, I found it lacking.
Well, Stories from the City is obviously a like poppiest album.
It's got much slicker production than the earlier ones, much, much more.
But I love it partially for that reason.
Yeah. What, her or Stories?
Stories.
Was that the first one Mick Harvey's on with her?
I don't know if it was the first one, to be honest, I'm not sure.
He's definitely on that album. And there's that beautiful collaboration with Tom York
He's on three tracks. There's one where he's doing actual singing words, but I think there's two of them where he's doing sort of like ooh-type backing vocals. And that kind of thing.
He's not doing like the
Dorset backing vocals.
Well, she is from Dorset and did live on a farm for years.
she farmed parrots.
Obviously. Parrot eggs for breakfast.
Yes.
But we digress. But so I mean, people really like her. Really, their early albums. I mean, Dry. It's bluesy. It's grungy. It's just bursting with sexual energy. And then Rid of Me kind of continued that. It's raw desire. It's muffled guitars. It's dirty bass lines. I mean, that was the Albini produced one.
Albini's production on that is one of the rawest things I've heard Albini.
Don't forget, though, he's not a producer.
Sorry, Albini's recording.
Yeah, he just sets up some mics and lets people go at it, really.
Everything that he's worked on, it always says recorded by Ryan.
He doesn't. He insists.
Yeah.
But I think he really brings something out in artists.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every album.
I don't know, he's probably got Hatebreed motivational posters up in the studio or something.
I don't know.
He's mainly busy playing poker in the studio.
He's a big poker fan.
Poker fan, and there was a band recently that got annoyed with him because he was playing online poker while he was producing their album. But he was saying that's how he concentrates on the mix.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he sits and listens to it as he would listen to it at home.
Yeah.
And that's what he would be doing if he was at home. So it's his way of sort of working. He's really, really interesting guy, Steve Albini. I've read there's an article that is really worth tracking down, where he wrote an article about how bands are just completely screwed by the recording industry.
Yeah.
And there was also an internet forum for poker players.
Yes, I read that intently because it became obvious that one person posting was Albini, and he was like, "Fuck it, just ask me anything."
Yeah, and he just did a full question and answer session, and was really, really open.
Oh, that's amazing.
If I can find the link, I will.
See, it was on the Skull Club, wasn't it, back in the day?
I'll try and put it in the text in the text bit on this podcast.
Yeah. Did you read his letter to Nirvana?
That might be is that the same as the one I was talking about with the article about how screwed they are, or is that a separate one?
No, I think it's a separate one. I think it was a letter to Cobain.
Yes, about
producing them. Yeah, yes. And what they expected out of it, and I think it said everything you need to know about Albini and his approach to producing in inverted commas, which you can't see on a recording. It said everything you need to know about him.
Yeah.
He doesn't pull punches either, does he?
No.
If he doesn't like a band, he would tell you.
Yeah, he wouldn't record with a band if he didn't like them.
Which is pretty cool.
Which, considering he recorded with Bush, is quite surprising. I like that album too, just to be honest.
Okay.
He's done so many different bands though, like Neurosis and Mono.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that one with the ridiculous title, like Flag Fluttered and Sunset, the Mono album. He did that.
I did My Father, My King by Mogwai as well.
Yeah.
Which you can tell if you listen to it. But
back to Sonic Cathedrals.
Going back to PJ Harvey, obviously.
Yeah, shall we?
What are we talking about? She's... interesting one, actually. My wife, who is not a big music fan, she would fully admit that she doesn't really know very much about music. She knows what she likes, but to sort of get ideas for what to talk about in the podcast, I was sort of talking through with her and going through the bands and saying, well, you know, what do you know about these? And she said, well, PJ Harvey, she's a bit like the female Nick Cave, which... PJ Harvey would probably not be very happy about that.
No, not now.
As he's her ex-boyfriend. However, there's a lot of... It's a good comment because they both changed their styles throughout the career.
Well, she's another musical chameleon, isn't she? I mean...
Like Optimus Bowie.
She's a transformer. She changes herself almost with every album. She doesn't repeat things.
Well, it's... White Chalk, your favourite.
My favourite, which I will expand on at length in a moment.
I watched a little interview with her on YouTube.
Yeah.
And the reason that album is all piano based was she wanted to challenge herself.
Yeah, she learnt to play piano.
She doesn't play piano. And she says basically what she was doing is pretending that she was a virtuoso piano. She was sitting at the keyboard and just like waving her arms in the air and like playing really flamboyantly as if she was Mozart or someone like that. And then just recording it and seeing what came out and then picking out the bits that worked and refining them into songs. But in watching the...
She also had John Parrish on that album with her as well.
Yeah, but I've watched loads of YouTube videos over the last couple of weeks of little interviews with her, little bits of her in the studio and things like that, and it's completely changed my perception of how she is as a person.
Okay.
Because I think because of what her music sounds like, I'd always had a perception that she's a really serious, almost humourless person. She's not. She's very sort of normal. She's sitting there. There's a video of when they were doing the album artwork.
Mm-hmm.
There's loads of Polaroid photos of her that she'd taken of herself, like in mirrors throughout her entire career up to that point. And she was sitting there with it was a friend of hers who's the art director. and they were just sitting there, and I think they'd probably had a couple of glasses of wine, and they were just sort of falling about laughing, looking at these pictures and these random little typed up phrases that they'd got all over it and stuff like that.
I think interviews can be slightly terse with her, though.
Yeah.
A lot of her lyrics really aren't up for discussion in interview.
Yeah. Well, they're so personal, aren't
they? Yeah, yeah, so and personal.
I suppose it's like, the lyrics are there, I've said what I'm saying on that subject.
Yeah.
Don't ask.
And that's it, I'm not going there. Don't ask me about my Nick Cave split or whatever. Don't ask me about my about abortion. Don't ask me. Yeah. Although,
which is, you wouldn't in a public conversation.
Well, no, you wouldn't, would you? Although she has said in interview when she did To Bring You My Love, which there's narrative threads running through it. Each song is a different narrative from a different woman, and they're not autobiographical. But she said she almost got hate mail at the time, people thinking they were. I mean, down by the water, you know, people were actually believing that she'd had a child and drowned it. And she's like, you know, guys, this isn't me.
Yeah.
So, no, I guess, not humorless.
No, she, which...
But I like her at her darkest. I mean, well, no surprise there, hey.
No, not really.
White Chalk, it is my favourite. I don't know anybody else who would rate White Chalk as their number one Polly album.
I didn't even listen to it up until quite recently. I knew When Under Ether.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'd not really given it much of a listen. Until we were doing this podcast, and it's a great album.
It's the one I come back to time and time again. I will play it obsessively. There's a line on it, all of my being is now in pining, and that's just how I feel when I listen to it. It is...
Pining for the fjords.
And it is mostly stark vocal and piano, and it's just intense, and it's haunting. And she sings a lot of it in a higher register.
Yeah.
And some of the notes she reaches, they just really get to me. It's not easy listening. I mean, the album, like, tears me to pieces. But it just speaks to me. And it makes me want to sit in a corner in a darkened room and dig my fingernails into my palms until I draw blood.
Yeah, I love listening to albums that make me feel
Yep.
I know that sounds
every
weird,
day.
But I mean, there's actually a line in the title track, White Chalk, that describes that, digging your fingernails into your palms and I see blood. But that's what it makes me feel. It's like just such...
So it's not even that she's subliminally suggested that, she's actually subliminally suggested.
Yeah.
Is that the right word?
It is now.
Okay.
I mean, the lyrics to When Under Ether and to Broken Harp and to the piano, they break me entirely. It's just gut-wrenching emotion.
Yeah.
And
for me, of the albums that I know that well, that's why I think Rid of Me is such a hard listen.
Yeah.
But at the time, I used to have I bought the Peel Sessions. No, it wasn't the Peel Sessions. It was the four-track demos for Rid of Me, which she released just afterwards, which is basically like Rid of Me, but even rawer.
Yeah.
Because she's recording
I'm sounding like the microphone's the other side of the room.
Yeah.
Like our first two episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just like that.
Before we discovered EQ.
And individual mics.
Yeah. Well, that's the first seven episodes up until now.
Yes.
So,
but I mean, well, Ian, you listened to When Under Ether on the...
Probably.
Okay.
That was the piano we
wanted. Yes. No, I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I enjoyed all of them. Like, I don't know.
I mean, I imagine you'd have probably preferred the more driven guitar ones. I don't know, like 50-foot Queenie or something.
It fitted better with the alternating between that and Hatebreed, yes.
Yeah.
But, no, I liked the more... I did like the starker stuff. I did.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it a lot.
I mean, I know you don't shy away from emotion in music.
No, it's definitely something that I'm going to dig into more. I hadn't ever really given her the time of day, to be honest.
She just sort of completely off your radar kind of thing.
She was on my radar. Like, I you can't not be aware of it. But I just, I don't know. I think I just decided that I probably wouldn't enjoy it. As I do with so many... I think... This is probably going to be a recurring thing. There's a stupid song title, and it put me off.
Right.
Like, I didn't listen to Block Party for ages, and like I didn't listen to Biffy Clyro for ages. No, it's not. It's because I thought they had a shit name.
Sheila and the Gig?
Yes.
Thought so.
That's the one.
Whereas brilliant song.
I know, it's I fucking love the song now that I've listened to it, but like, that's the... one of the songs that people talk about all the time, and it's like, ah, oh, that looks like that's a fucking stupid title. I don't want to listen to it. It's bullshit. It's something that I'm trying to get past.
Isn't it an old folk tale or something?
Sheila and a Gig is I think it's pagan, but it's a gargoyle, but a very sexually exaggerated gargoyle.
That makes sense with the lyrics.
With the lyrics, when you listen to it,
Yeah, see, the only bit of the lyrics I didn't understand was Sheila and a Gig. But yeah,
it's possibly more explicit than I want to go into on this podcast what exactly is entailed in Sheila and a Gig, gargoyles.
You can look it up if you're over 18.
If you listen to this and you're not over 18, you're probably having the same reaction we had when we first listened to Guns N' Roses. Oh my god, they said fuck! A lot!
But then when we move on from White Chalk, so that one was in 2007, and then her next album, and she totally reinvented herself again and came back in 2011 with Let England Shake, and which... well, it was critically acclaimed. She won the Mercury Prize for it.
The critics loved it, and I don't get it at all.
I thought you liked it.
Really? I just, about 2 weeks ago, I finally clicked with it. I hated this album at first, and it's still probably my least favourite.
It's nearly my least favourite.
After
I don't get it still.
Actually, thinking about it, it's probably my second least favourite. Is probably my least favourite because it's got Words That Maketh Murder.
Right.
Which I think is a brilliant song.
The
opening track, the first track on there is the title track, and it's... she's singing in an even higher register.
Yeah, it's very unnatural.
It's like a forced...
I think it's forced. It's very contrived somehow.
Well, this is the thing. I think that what she's done on that album is... not so much these days, but I used to be quite a big fan of Bright Eyes.
Yes.
Bright Eyes has a thing on nearly all of the albums where the opening track is... deliberately difficult to listen to.
Okay.
Like for one album, it starts with a young child reading a storybook and sort of getting stuck on the words, and it's really... if you've ever sat and listened to a child reading their reading book at school, it's really frustrating because you're just like, no, get to the next word. He's opened an album with that, and then there's another album where the first song was recorded in the back of their car on the way to a gig. So it's got loads of road noise and everything.
Yeah.
It's just recorded on a dictaphone, I think. Yeah. Just sitting there with an acoustic guitar. And I don't know for definite, but that's the perception that I've got, is that she's made that album willfully difficult to listen to try and put off casual.
I mean, you know, the album before, I mean, she'd already started singing in a higher register, but then with Let England Shake, well, it went from the sublime to the ridiculous for me.
Yeah, and it's but White Chalk has still got really beautiful melodies, and you can't really say that so much on... I mean, Let England Shake, it's got really weird time signatures all over the place.
It's got the most the most interesting instruments in it, though. I mean, they've got harmonium all over it.
And auto harp.
And it really makes me wish I could play my auto harp. that's, in fact, yeah, maybe that's why I don't like Let England Shake. It just reminds me I own an auto harp and I can't play it.
Isn't your auto harp broken and impossible to tune? Isn't that why?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it might sound like Let England Shake if you do.
It probably would. Right, on my second album, I'm going to do PJ Harvey Let England Shake.
But her album after that, Hope Six Demolition Project, you're not that keen on it.
No.
I really like it.
Well, see, I have real issue with this album. It's Polly using her position of privilege to make social commentary for some avant-garde art project.
Did you read the same Guardian interview that I read before the album came out then?
Possibly, and I also heard an interview with her on the radio.
She got accused of poverty tourism, because basically she went to a really poor, like, ghettoised area
of Washington.
Washington, D.C.
Right.
It's an area where they were... They're pulling down all the houses to regenerate an area, basically social cleansing.
Yeah.
And she paid a driver to take her around while she took notes, and she had someone else with her taking photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took real issue, and I didn't even want to listen to this album after I'd heard that.
Isn't it just the same as an investigative journalist doing it? It's telling those people's story.
Yeah.
You could look at it that way.
Maybe.
It may have been done in a bit of a ham-fisted way, but I think that's what her intention was. I think she felt empathy for these people.
I've no doubt.
I think that she wanted to bring their story
yeah.
to a wider world.
Mm. I mean, in fact, I didn't actually buy the album until after, because we went to see her live on that tour.
Yeah.
Awful warehouse venue.
I quite liked it.
Did you?
The view was rubbish, but I liked the vibe of it.
But and I bought the album.
Starworks Warehouse.
I bought the album after that just because actually it came across really well live.
It was great.
Got a real energy.
Such a good live band.
Yeah.
As well.
But there's too much sax on it though for me.
Well, it's.
And I know. Yeah, she's a saxophone player. I know.
But yeah, she's got like a lot of the songs where nearly everybody in the band is playing brass instruments and stuff like that, aren't they?
You have to be careful with saxophone, really. You can overuse it dramatically.
We're back to 80s Bowie again.
But it's got like the really big baritone sax kind of thing and stuff like that, which Bon Iver uses a fair bit.
Oh no, there's someone else with the high register and difficult to listen to songs, hey?
Yes, but brilliant. I don't find him difficult to listen to at all.
22 a million is really hard to get into.
It's amazing.
It took me so long to get into that album, and it just about clicked, and then he cancelled the fucking tour that we'd got tickets to.
This is true.
And I was gutted.
Still not forgiven him.
Well, no, I haven't.
I've seen him live before.
And he's put out some new dates, and to some of the shows, selected shows, they were offering priority tickets to people
that had
tickets
to the London date.
No.
So that's why he's not.
So
tickets.
So he can fuck off. I'm not going to see him now.
Oh, I'm still going if he does another gig.
Well, you're on your own
to.
This time then.
How many albums has Bon Iver done? Because I've only heard for Emma
three,
for
just
ago.
The three.
Oh wow, I need to catch up then.
They're both, all three of them are really good, but
very different. It might as well be three different bands, in fact.
Yeah.
Kind of like PJ Harvey, a lot
exactly.
of hers, yeah.
Exactly. It's more.
But I like that in an artist.
This high pitched Transformers is what we're saying, yeah.
But so I'm thinking one Polly Harvey song that you actually would have heard then and might have liked was the collaboration she did with Josh Homme.
Crawl Home.
I was thinking Wanna Make It With You.
We honestly haven't encountered my Josh Homme-a-phobia.
Can I just point out, this is brilliant, this is a first for the podcast. You've both pronounced his name incorrectly.
It's Homme, isn't it?
It's Homme.
Really?
Yes.
I only pronounced it like that just so I could make that homophobia joke.
I never knew that.
I think he's a prick.
Really?
Yes, such a prick. I read a couple of interviews with him and I was like, you are a fucking prick, sir. And I just can't get into Queens because of that.
What about Caius?
See, that's the thing, right? I heard a couple of Caius tracks and I'm like, oh no, I dig this. But yeah, I just don't... I don't
get his
whole...
So you've not heard that song then with her singing on?
She was on... Josh Homme does, or used to, he's not done one for years, used to do a thing called Desert Sessions, where they just...
Yeah.
Basically, it was a group of musicians just used to go out to their studio in the desert, stay there for a week, and just write and record.
I need to look these up, actually. Someone... when I was tweeting about PJ Harvey this week, someone was going, oh God, have you listened to the Desert Sessions? Well, and I haven't.
Well, the ones that she's on, which I think is Desert Sessions 7 and 8, because they're all two of them in each CD, I've got a feeling they're out of print and difficult to get hold of these days.
Right.
They're not on Spotify or anything like that. But she, the one that she was on, they did I Want to Make It With You, which then ended up as a Queens of the Stone Age song.
Yeah.
And I believe was the first dancer at Ian's drummer John's wedding.
Yes, it was.
Because I was the DJ. but there's a song called Crawl Home as well that she did with them that's, I think, even better.
Right.
But, yeah. She's... I'm a big fan, definitely.
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. We can tell. Well
done. I quite like her.
But I think we perhaps need to wrap it up, don't we?
I think... Again,
we've possibly gone.
We're going into the realm of very long episodes.
There's been too much gushing. Yeah.
So what's our next episode after this one? We'll get to I.
That will be the letter I. So we will be talking about The Imagined Village and Iron Maiden.
I can't wait.
Well, like, we're not going to have to.
Spoilers.
We aren't.
No, we are. We're doing it in 5 minutes' time.
You, on the other hand, will have to wait.
For 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
So, yeah. Right, we've been Weed Dipping Music.
We've been Weed Dipping Music.
If you could see what face Colin just pulled now. If I'd got a photo of that, that would be the front page of the podcast.
So, this is Weed Dipping Music. Thank you very much for listening. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
This is H, isn't it? This is a H episode.
H. There is no H at the start of the word H. A-I-T-C-H.
I'm going to go, this letter is the episode. I've always said H.
H.
H-I-J-H. No, that does not sound right, man.
H-I-J-K, L-M-N-O-P.
H.
It starts with an A.
How? It's the fucking letter!
Yeah, and L starts with E-L. That's how you'd phonetically write.
Oh, shit, yeah. Otherwise it'd be L...
Yep.
Oh, man, that's messing with my head.
It's blown your just fucking just tiny like, mind.
Just like...
Like X, E-X.
Yeah. Was it... No, because that's...
Otherwise it...
And Y starts with a W.
X is X. H sounds like the fucking Queen.